Well, welcome. To start with, what I'd like to do is actually, even before a few people arrived early, we had a chance to ask people what their interest in coming here to a talk on nanomedicine and cancer drugs. And we heard from at least one person, they were interested in the startup, the investment phase in going through nanobiology. I was curious because since we have so few people that maybe I could just very quickly ask what were some of the reasons that people were interested in this so that I can point out some of this in my talk.
Interest in the subject matter.
Okay, from a interest point of view or in research?
No.
Okay, yeah. Exactly. Okay, so the computing IT. Others?
I want to know what exactly is nanomedicine.
Okay.
It's a new term.
All right. Yes. Combination of nano and medicine.
Yes.
So for me, just I don't know how to relate business and technology with the nano medicine and medical field.
Okay.
So
I'm
just curious.
I'm interested in the transformation
of business. Oh, okay.
How we can bring
to commercialization and business.
Well, I'm a year one engineer student, so I think it's better for me to know some know something from other disciplines. And I, when I look at the topic, I saw ecology and new nanomedicine and also business and technology, so many disciplines. So I'm interested in how you bring them together.
Okay. Well, great. Then it sounds like Paul's introduction was very apropos, that this is the intersection of all of these things. So what we're going to cover is three major topics. Kind of how the war against cancer started and how nanomedicine is has been involved in that. We'll talk about John, a member of the clinical trials, the human clinical trials, and the tale of two treatments, one traditional and one more advanced using nanomedicines. And then we'll talk about three key innovations in drug delivery, in the business model that's used for virtual biotech startups, and then the piece of computing, where computational modeling has come in and may actually change quite dramatically the development cycles for cancer drugs and nano drug delivery systems. So we'll try and cover all of this in a little less than an hour, but I think you'll see that all of these pieces actually fit together. So it was in 1971 that President Nixon, along with trying to funding some effort in the war against cancer, announced that it was really a war that needed to be mounted, and that there was a hope that it would, in a few years' time, and this was 1971, that with enough funding and enough research, that we would conquer this enemy. But in 2001, we know that there's new ammunition in terms of new drugs, but certainly cancer has not been conquered. And here we are in 2012, and we still have, in Time magazine covers, even doctors who have lived a very healthy lifestyle, have done all the things that we now know are helpful in lowering the statistical chances of getting cancer, and he finds out that he's going to be a cancer patient, and what that feels like as a doctor. So we have more than 10 million new cases per year of cancer. And this is an enormous societal drain, if you think of it. Plus, we have this increasing issue of the fact that many of the new cases are in developing countries where they have less ability, lower ability to pay for the treatments that even exist. So you have a situation where money and the whole healthcare systems and the World Healthcare Organizations are staggering under this immense load. What we're seeing is that in the States, for example, you know, even though there are 10 to 12 million new cases per year, about 8 million people die per year. So that there's a decrease in the death rates per the new cases. But that's partially because if you are to take a cancer drug, it might cost you anywhere from $2,000 to $7,000 a treatment in the States. Radiology, as you know, and all of that ends up being very having a lot of side effects. And then, of course, it turns out surgery is the most common treatment for cancer, but that the difficulty is that it's not a long-term sustaining treatment. Often there will be follow-on effects, so that successful surgery 5 years later may have a relapse in a different organ with tumors. So our difficulty and the whole issue for the pharmaceutical industry, if you're thinking about drugs against cancer, is that earlier the cost of development was high at $250 million. Now it's about $1.5 billion per new drug. The time to market is 10 years. 10 years previously, it's getting longer. New chemical entities is what NCE means with active ingredients. Maybe there were 40 that we would discover, and now maybe less than 30. And most blockbuster patents are set to expire in the next 2 to 5 years. So pharmaceutical companies are anticipating a patent cliff. And in fact, in 2013, all of the data seems to show if none of the drugs that are in development become blockbusters, something like 9 out of 10 of the top pharmaceutical companies could be lost producing by a year or two. So we're talking about a major issue in the pharmaceutical companies. So what is the promise of nanotechnology in medicine and cancer treatment? And what is nanomedicine? Actually, it's using nanotechnology for creating medicines or therapies. So it's an application area for nanotechnology. And what happens is the scope of most of the study that this was looking at is in this range. So 10 to the minus ninth, so 1 to 100 nanometers. What happens is that nanotechnologies can have an impact. It seems like making something smaller can actually make it react differently and do have different mechanisms in the body. And so we'll talk about that in a little bit more detail. So there are nanomedicines out in the market, about 30 plus. So they can range from using nanoparticles for diagnostics, for monitoring, and then also for treatment. And so we'll talk about all of those, but we'll really focus a lot on what is going on in this cancer treatment area. There is a global race, and that's why I think it's important from the financial or business side to know that people believe it's going to be, and most governments believe it's going to be a $70 billion biopharmaceutical market. And so right now, the U.S., Japan, Germany, and South Korea are the most advanced. They're dominant where activity, R&D intensity, and government support are very high. Cluster number two seems to be followers, where effort dedicated to nanotech activities is reasonable. Number three, there's niche countries. And number four, there are quite a few laggards, where development intensity is reasonable, but the level of activities is very low. And so you can see that cluster three and four, that a number of countries have to make a major commitment to nanotechnology to really get it off the ground. So that gives me an opportunity to just go ahead and tell you a little bit more in video form, spoken by two of the very important researchers in this field, this area of drug delivery systems. The idea that not only can you make a drug that exists already very small and make it into a nanoparticle by making it tiny, but you can also encapsulate it in some way in a drug delivery system and then target it so that it goes somewhere specific in the body and doesn't destroy other cells that are healthy, but goes directly to the tumor that it wants to destroy. And so we'll hear a little bit more about this from the mouths of two of the important researchers in this area.
Dr. Yolanda Colson is an associate professor in thoracic surgery at BWH. She's one of several physicians who use nanoparticles to kill cancer cells. Her focus is on lung cancer. Her colleague, Dr. Omid Farrakhzad, runs the Laboratory of Nanomedicine, focusing on the use of nanoparticles to cure prostate cancer.
So we're able to engineer nanotechnology for cancer application that can identify the differences between a normal cell and a cancer cell, and specifically kill the cancer cell while leaving a healthy cell alone.
These nanoparticles travel the same pathways in the body that a tumor cell takes.
The nanoparticles we've now developed basically carry a chemotherapy drug inside them and are able to recognize a cancer cell, bind to the surface of the cancer cell, get internalized, and then once inside of the cancer cell to release that chemotherapy drug over an extended period of time.
Then we can concentrate our drug, use less drug at that site, have less side effects, and not deliver it to places we don't need it. After surgery and the large tumors have been removed, it's really to prevent recurrence, either right at the site of the surgery or within the lymph nodes, which are the most common local areas of getting tumor back.
Dr. Colson says nanoparticles' usefulness extends way beyond treating lung or prostate cancer.
There's no reason that it wouldn't work in all cancers. It just would probably depend on us changing how we use it or working at a way to make it target specific tumor cells directly.
Nanoparticles are also being used to determine the course of disease by pathologists like Dr. Massimo Loda, who runs the Loda Lab at BWH.
The nanotechnology allows us to probe the tumor tissue for the presence or absence of biomarkers.
Biomarkers are the expressions of genes that a pathologist uses to determine a person's risk for certain diseases, like breast or prostate cancer. For his work, Dr. Loda uses a specific type of nanoparticle called a quantum dot.
If you're looking at tissue using quantum dots, you will see different areas of a particular tumor light up with different colors, and that gives us a wealth of information in terms of the expression of genes that we previously didn't know were there.
Okay, so that gives us a little bit of a description, and as a result, this is the... Oops, I guess we have to take this off. Okay, so we've kind of covered very quickly sort of a little bit of a background on the war against cancer and nanomedicine and where we are. And so now we're going to move pretty quickly to John and the Tale of Two Treatments. John is a cancer drug trial volunteer. What happens is that for phase three drug trials, often what will happen is there'll be a very small group of people that will be selected who have tried almost everything else, but where the treatments have not been helpful. And so John would be a case like that, where he would be interested in trying to be a human subject, because when he tries these drugs, it's likely he will be able to live maybe 2 years' time versus 3 or 4 months' time. What happens is that you'll start by having phase one and phase two kinds of trials that are done in mice and in monkeys that will show very positive results. And then in phase three, we'll go to human trial. The key issue is how to kill the tumor without endangering the patient. So the problem is the major side effects in 90-plus FDA-approved chemotherapy drugs. So here you have existing drugs that have gone through this 10 or 15-year process, but they are so toxic that they cannot be used very often, or they can only be used in such low dosages that they actually are not effective in killing the tumor. The solution is to find better safety and efficacy with what we call programmed nano-engineered DDS, stands for drug delivery systems. And so here would be an example. Targeted polymeric nanoparticles, TNP, are actually what we call smart bombs for cancer tumors. So just like the idea of having a bomb that actually knows where it's supposed to go and has some amount of intelligence, right now what they can do, this is a blown-up version of a nanoparticle, that inside is a payload. So you can deliver a broad range of molecules, let's say an already existing FDA drug, approved drug, that has been proven to be extremely toxic. But if you cover it with this protective layer or encapsulate it, then you shield it from the body's immune system, and it also is then time released and not and doesn't damage other cells. Then you add to that targeted molecules on the surface that guide the package to its target. So if you imagine this all in a nanoparticle, 5,000 of which could encircle a human hair, this is pretty amazing that we can work at that level and through biomaterials engineering actually create these nanoparticles. So if I were to describe the first generation, maybe 10 years back, would be to just take the medicine and scale it down, make it very small, and see if it had a different, if it had different properties at that time. And that actually produced two or three very active drugs that were patented and are now on the marketplace. It also was able to show what we call this EPR effect, where it was discovered that these nanoparticles, because a tumor vasculature or the way it grows and provides blood to to the cancer cells in its tumor, had a different kind of architecture than normal vasculature, that any of these particles, if it would get into the tumor, would somehow get stuck there. And as such, would stay there a longer period of time and actually do its job. So the first was this kind of passive effect where it was discovered if you made just the medicine smaller, some of them would find their way to the right tumors, stay there, and be more effective than a larger sized particle. The second generation was a number of different kinds of nanomedicines, viruses, liposomes, antibodies, all of these nano-sized, but using different kinds of mechanisms. The third generation, which is right where we are now, is nanoengineering the drug delivery system for precise targeting. And what just happened this spring with a company that was developed by the doctor that you saw speak in the Dr. Farakud and his associate, Dr. Langer, who is well known in the chemical engineering field at MIT. So an MIT-Harvard grouping put together this virtual biotech firm. They actually ended up being keeping their academic positions, but acting as chief scientists for a new biotech company, and in we'll show you the exact time period, but in a number of years, much shorter than most biotech companies, they've actually gotten to a clinical trial, 2006 to 12, they've actually gotten to a chemical trial as well as shown that they can do what they had originally set out to do, which was, let me see if I can get this to work at one point. The gray is a time-release polymer. Inside is this payload drug. Around it is a protective layer. And on the outside is this targeting ligand, which is actually the targeting ligand. So remember what they were saying as being how you could make a small molecule and encapsulate it and make it into a smart bomb to kill tumors? They actually were able to do that. And in April of 2012, so this spring, there was the first targeted nanoparticle drug trials in human clinical trials. They put an existing payload, docetaxel, which is actually a cancer drug, and they made it small, put this payload drug in the polymer with a protective layer, put targeted ligands, and their results were in several cases, one prostate cancer model, the other tumor targeting model, actually 10 times efficacy. And in several cases, like John's case, he actually had a complete remission where the tumor essentially disappeared over a 24 to 48 hour period of time. So really surprising results when you could take existing drugs but get them to the place where they were supposed to go in a drug delivery system.
So they make the vehicle, they don't make the drug.
Exactly. And that's what is what we find quite interesting is the fact that if you think of the issue, and I'll show you some of the statistics later, of how many drugs essentially fail at the safety efficacy test after 10 years of kind of being in the system, that if you could resurrect a number of those by just making them smaller and putting them in a targeted vehicle, you might in some ways save a number of the patent cliffs that are existing, because here are companies that have spent huge amounts of money to make a drug that they can't sell because FDA will not approve it at the level that's necessary to be effective for a human trial.
No, you don't save those patents, though.
Well,
because
they don't.
They become generic.
Well, you know what's interesting? They don't. There's a new 505(b)(2), which is a only FDA nano-specific patent law, which says that if something in its original form in the nano state with a unique encapsulation or drug delivery system has significantly different clinical efficacy and mechanism than previously, it can be actually, it first gets a 5-year sort of marketing exclusivity, and then it can actually receive a patent in that time period if it proves itself out. So there's a special kind of fast-track process that not very many companies have been able to go through that we believe with some of the computational work that we're doing, we might be able to prove out the actual mechanism that would bring these kinds of drugs to patent protection. But that's a very good point. So third-generation human trials, MIT's Langer and Harvard Med School Farrakhan-Sad were the ones who did that. Some of these are just some of the other areas that have some areas of competence and are building these company kind of incubators for cancer nanobiotech kinds of companies in the States. So we've covered the first two areas, John, the Tale of Two Treatments, one, the traditional treatment that failed, the second, using a nano-engineered drug delivery system, which was extremely effective for him, And now we're going to go and talk about the area that I've been working in, these three key innovations that I think is going to usher in a fourth generation of nano drug delivery systems. But I'll start with a little story. The story is, in 2004, the National Aerospace and Space Agency, which has a very large facilities in Ames in Silicon Valley, shut down its wind tunnels and switched to computational fluid dynamics. What does that mean? It means that at some point in time, in 2004, they realized that all these tunnels where they used to physically measure the impact of wind on an aerodynamic design of a plane or of a new space rocket or of any kind of vehicle was no longer as effective and as accurate and as precise as computationally calculating and modeling the wind the wind effects on any given shape. So if you think of it, it's almost as large in the aerospace industry, this kind of shift, as our shift in the IT industry from atoms to bits. It's the idea that in somehow that no longer do you need physical simulation sites. You have so much computational power and so much more understanding of the fluid dynamics, the pressure points, that you can actually more accurately model something on the computer than you can measuring it in real life. So this was a very important switch, because what we're seeing is that computational fluid dynamics was actually, for the aerospace industry, what we call game-changing. Any time you have a 10-time increase in accuracy, a 10-time increase in speed at 1/10 the cost, it totally disrupts and transforms an industry. And that's what we're seeing as an inflection point here. Oh, this started working again. Maybe it just needed time to warm up. Inflection point for the aerospace industry. But I think that this 10-time change you've seen in the web, you've seen in a number of industries like the smartphone industry, right? We've seen this in a number of different industries, and what I'm proposing and hoping to show you is that the same kind of inflection point or game changing could be happening in the drug delivery and drug discovery world as well. And that's what we believe is going on with what we can do with nanotechnology and nanotechnology simulation. So let me just show you. So what we've been working on is computational fluid dynamics that can computationally virtualize nanodrug delivery development. The difficulty that we have now, and the big problem, is all of the things we know in computing and in Moore's law is we have an exponential learning curve. Anytime you can have physical chemical characterization, membrane interaction, all of these things, you can start getting down the learning curve very quickly, because you gather data, the data feeds on itself, and digitally you actually start to speed up your ability to do more and more modeling. The problem we have in the drug delivery and the drug development world is it is essentially what we would call Edisonian. It's trial and error. A doctor says, "Oh, I think that if I make this particular combination of chemicals, let's try it out on a mouse and see if it works. I mean, it's to a large extent the knowledge management cycle is very long, because in each case you're making a move from, let's say, a mouse to a monkey to a different species when you're doing experimentation. And so it's not at all a surprise that many medicines and very many pharmaceuticals that you use in a trial and error way that might work on one species ends up not panning out for another species. And so to get from a mouse to a human being can take a long time, and you can fail on any part of the way. I mean, they're clearly not good correlates all the way. On the other hand, if you could, just like the airplane, be able to virtualize that and actually start using the data and putting together the data and building on that data, cutting and slicing it, making it possible to crowdsource the data, all of a sudden you have a game-changing kind of event. And so what we believe is that the fourth generation will be virtualizing the nanoengineering of drug delivery, that if it took 6 years for the Bind Bioscience company to find the right combination of polymers and of drug delivery system and test it through mice and monkeys and then human beings, that you could computationally characterize what the molecule looked like, then you could do better in the nano drug delivery development cycle and work very closely with pharmaceutical companies that have data already on the activity and mechanisms of their pharmaceuticals that are already existing for cancer drugs, and then use a virtual biotech startup business model that's highly capital efficient to get this out in the marketplace and commercialize it more quickly. So this is just an example of one of the recent papers that some of my colleagues at Stanford have put together to show the kind of nanocomputational characterization that you could use to analyze mechanisms during development of pharmaceuticals. What they're talking about here is what they've done is actually show, using quantum dots, the differential extravasation between Q dots across three tumor types. And so what they discovered by actually doing this modeling and simulation of the nanoparticles was that actually, and this has just been published, size and shape matters. It turns out that different tumors have very different vasculature. And so you could have, depending on what tumor type you had, you might want to have a nanoparticle that was shaped like a sphere. In another, you might want it shaped like a carbon nanotube. In another, you might make a very different shape that looked like a sombrero. And those are all possible to actually form and shape if you knew which one was best suited to a particular vasculature of tumor. So you could actually customize your delivery vehicle to different kinds of tumors. Another thing that one of the graduate now at University of Illinois has been working on, new fluorescent nanoparticles for imaging, so that you can get more information on each of these nanoconjugate probes so that there could be better computational kinds of resolution in what was going on in each of the mechanisms in the body. So the idea would be that the value to the users would be able to, if you had these kinds of customized drug delivery systems, you could shrink tumors with fewer chemotherapy side effects. Drugs are very costly due to their R&D costs of about $354 million per drug. This is just a PwC report that looked at the average cost of R&D by therapy area. So depending on what sort of area, in cancer, it was about 600, close to 600 million by therapy area. The value to corporate partners would be 2 times faster and 10 times the safety and efficacy. So you could use FDA-approved chemical drugs and well-known antigens. You would screen and analyze, 100 plus different kinds of drug delivery system nanoparticles. And you might cut the 6 years of time getting to the phase three review of 73 candidates. Right now, the current development system is broken. It takes 1.5 years to get to phase one, takes 2 more years to get through phase two, at which time you're supposed to have a confidence in the mechanism and a confidence in the safety. You get to 3 years, so you're almost at 1.2, 3, and it's in phase three that you'll have 73 candidates, so 73 drug candidates that have gotten that far. 31 will be proven unsafe before they reach the end of phase three, and 57% ineffective. That's a terrible dropout rate after spending close to 8 years to get there. So that's really the cost. The cost is so many of the drugs we're developing now and pharmaceutical companies are developing are not panning out. And our argument is part of that is because we're using this Edisonian trial and error on different animal types and not using the computational methods that are being developed in other areas but not being applied to the medical area.
So the two ads. So 88% are useless.
Right.
Okay.
88% are useless. I mean, that's a terrible thought. And that's where the cost goes up, because when you're looking at the average cost per drug, what you're doing is you're taking all of the costs for the whole portfolio of drugs that have gotten to that point, all 100 drugs that you have here, and you've paid of them, 88 of them, you've paid the same amount but haven't proven useful. So you attribute that entire cost, the cost of 100, to whatever works, which is only a few drugs, right? And so those few drugs, you have to charge $7,000 a treatment because it's carrying the cost of 80 drugs that didn't make it. So every pill you're taking is essentially 10 pills, of which 8 were proven ineffective. I think maybe my batteries are going.
Yeah,
somehow the batteries are not going.
They should get a Logitech.
Yeah, I think so, because it's not... I'm sorry. It was working fine. Okay. So I don't know. So I just want to point out, I was very, very enthusiastic about Atlas Ventures and Pure Ventures as a route for rapid commercialization that a number of universities have been thinking of doing. For example, this model... An LLC is a limited liability corporation. And any of you who are more familiar with venture funding is actually very similar to what a venture fund would look like. What happens is a number of investors, in many cases it's a university, plus some corporate limited partners, pharmaceutical companies, medical imaging companies, life sciences companies, will put money in, and then it will pass... Oh, great. Thank you.
Left and right.
Left okay. And what that means is that...
Not on the side.
Oh, no.
Just
this is,
there.
Okay. And they will create a drug company that's a limited liability corporation. So the drug company, unlike a pharmaceutical, will not be an active producer or creator of pharmaceutical drugs. It will just be the funding vehicle for a number of subsidiaries that are doing different projects. So the idea of this is that you're de-risking your portfolio, because right now, if you want to be a biotech startup, what you do is you actually go and raise money from a venture fund, and you put that money into one basket. So you put all your eggs in one basket in some ways. This idea is to say all the investors participate in a fund, almost like an incubation or development fund, that funds a number of entities. And any one of these entities can grow on their own, are considered to be C-corps, so their corporations, can be sold, can be acquired, can license, but their main licensing and the IT will be held by each of the target companies. And then there's a management company that specifically, in the case of professors, actually sort of pays them to be the scientific board, because the talent that you need for these kinds of biotech firms, it's hard to get, you know, the top Stanford professor to leave their position to start a company. On the other hand, they tend to have, you know, hundreds of graduate students who would be willing to help start a company if that one professor or academic was the chief scientific officer or technical officer guiding that company through its process. So this is similar to what has been done for a number of kind of virtual, what I call virtual biotech companies, because you have a passive non-operating fund that then actually has each of these companies being almost like projects that are started up and that are often only have two or three full-time people to prove concept, a proof of concept, and to interact with maybe some of the limited partners and to prove that a certain pharmaceutical drug will work, a certain drug delivery system will work, or a certain imaging system will work. And as soon as it kind of proves itself, then the heavy lifting, it's either acquired or it's licensed out, so that the limited partners that have the most reason for wanting to either distribute that or because they have the patent on the drug that is used as the main ingredient, they're the ones to go ahead and to take it to the next step, so that each C corporation startup in the portfolio is a virtual nanomedicine, almost a build to buy, as they call it, which is that investors and pharmaceuticals put in money, they form a corporation, the asset is developed, in other words, the proof of concept of a certain drug delivery to a certain tumor. Milestones are achieved, and when those milestones are achieved, there's a first right of refusal in some ways of the pharmaceutical to say, okay, I'm going to take that and I'm going to make it into a new drug or sell it, or I'm going to create a new formulation of it, a number of different options. And this has actually been done in two or three of the most profitable acquisitions have been built to buy in the biotech world in the past two or three years. And that's because it's really capital efficient. So, for example, Bind Bioscience ended up spending about $85 million in funding to get to its first human trials. What we believe a computational virtual startup could look like is maybe about 50% would be in the cluster that you needed for the computational work. You need to have at least a few computational dynamics postdocs, and you probably need a small microfluidics startup to just do one or two of the laboratory wet lab tests that you need to prove that your computational design actually worked and to create benchmarking. So in operating expenses, about $2 million a year, which is a lot less. So trying to do in the same way for biotech what has been proven to be the case for lots of startups in the valley, for web companies, kind of a small, you know, proof of concept, get it going, you know, figure out computationally what needs to be done, make it virtual until in some ways it's at a point it can be distributed and make its own money. So what we saw in the last 2 to 3 years is 2011 in biotech had 35 big exits. They were, none of them were IPOs. They were all about 8 to 10 billion upfront paid. So in other words, what happened was that they actually were acquired by pharmaceutical companies trying to fulfill their, trying to fill their pharmaceutical pipeline. So these companies are now starting to be almost like, you know, what is it like in baseball teams, like the field teams for a big pharmaceutical. And that works out fine in some ways for academics and for, you know, the kind of talent that is needed to make these things work. They would rather start a number of companies with several of their doctoral students or their teams and then go on and start yet another one. I think Langer has started something like 5 or 6. Steve Quake in Stanford has started 3. So there's really this, and both universities have been very happy to back these professors in their commercialization of their work, and they're also sort of making it, bringing from the lab to the bedside products that actually make a difference to patients. And so if one were to only, this is not quite correct, but if one was to only look at internal rate of return for realized rather than realized and unrealized back, we actually would have a pretty good pharmaceuticals or biopharmaceuticals actually did a lot better, and healthcare did a lot better than electronics, sorry to say. Okay, so my final slide is just, here are the key takeaways that I hope that you've heard in this talk. The first one is that nano-engineered drug delivery systems, so in other words, the vehicle, rather than only looking at the payload, the pharmaceutical, are becoming a key advance in the war against cancer. What we're seeing is that, like smart bombs, these drug delivery systems can target tumors, making John's cancer treatment 10 times more effective by just bringing the drug to the right place and time releasing it in an effective way. We can increase the efficacy and reduce the toxicity to other parts of the body. What I hope to show you is 3 key innovations that I believe are going to make a difference in the fourth generation, and that I'm working with a number of professors at Stanford to try to have happen. This nano drug delivery, virtual biotech startups, this idea that the talent is in the universities and that translating that and getting them to commercialization, potentially with a kind of a venture fund sort of incubator for these kinds of projects, make a lot of sense. And that the other piece is computational. If we can find a better way to develop drugs rather than the Edisonian trial and error animal experimentation that has been holding back and making the price of drug delivery of development so high, I think that that will be a major breakthrough and probably even a strategic kind of inflection point for the pharmaceutical industry. So there we go.